cliffcentral.com.
Lucy Hawking is an English journalist, novelist, educator, and philanthropist, and she's in South Africa to launch books which have been translated into Zulu and Xhosa, and which have to do with something which we're in sore and dire need of in South Africa, science education. Now, the surname may be somewhat familiar to those people who are interested in science or have been, I don't know, anything but comatose for the last 30 years. She is the daughter of theoretical physicist Stephen Hawking and writer Jane Wilde Hawking. And she also has her own family, which is burgeoning. There's William. We'll talk about him a little bit later on. You live in London most of the time. So yes. Is this your first time in South Africa?
This is. I've just arrived this morning. I have come to you fresh from the airport.
I'm so sorry. That means you weren't fresh at all. You're exhausted.
I'm quite fresh. You can come close. I don't smell.
I didn't mean that. I just meant you must be tired.
You've made me a lovely coffee. So I think the day is beginning now.
Well, Lucy, it's a pleasure to meet you. And I'm delighted that you're doing your bit for South Africa and for science in South Africa by having these books translated. It must be quite exciting to be able to come to a place which, as I said, so sorely needs any kind of intervention in science.
It's actually very moving. I've seen the books in Zulu and Xhosa for the first time today, and I felt tears come to my eyes because it's such an enormous achievement on the part of Presser and Carol Block, who've translated the books. The idea behind the book series is to use storytelling, to use creativity and humour and the tale of two kids who travel across the universe to engage young readers with science, young readers who might not pick up a book about science, but who would read a book about two kids traveling around the universe who would want to go on the adventures with them. And the universe that the kids explore is the real universe, so it's not a fantasy. So you learn through the adventure story, through the storytelling. And to have these books translated into Zulu and Xhosa is a phenomenal achievement and actually an enormous honour.
And it's called Once Upon a Time in the Universe.
That's the name of my talk that I'm giving tomorrow night because it's about science and storytelling. So it's about this thing that I've noticed.
We're going behind the fourth wall in the talk.
We are, because we're going to do a tour of the universe. We're going to meet some extraordinary people and see some incredible places. But we're also going to think very fundamentally about the role of imagination in science, how great scientists like Isaac Newton might have used his imagination, how we can all use our imagination through storytelling, but also especially for a young audience, looking forward to the future. What are the problems that they see around them and what imaginative solutions could they? And the talk ends with a challenge to the young audience, saying you need to use your imaginations to come up with solutions to the problems that you see around you.
And of course, there's so much to build on now, because this is the best time to be alive. There's so much information at everyone's disposal. There is so much more being discovered every day than we could possibly have had an aptitude for.
That's
before.
Right, but it needs to be collated in a way for kids, because one thing that is happening for kids is that it can almost go to the other extreme, and you can have information overload. You can have problems with understanding what is a real story, what is not a real story. And by bringing this kind of narrative together and working with some really great scientists, you know, some world-leading scientists contribute to this book series, it's a way of saying to kids, this is information you can trust. These are people who are talking to you in their own voices about their experiences in science, their careers, their research, what they've done. And I kind of hope it opens up a doorway for kids who might not have had any contact with science, never thought, oh, what does a scientist do? And if you've never thought about what does a scientist do?
People who think it's too hard.
Oh, yeah, exactly. Well, if kids go away from my talks or reading my books with one message, which is science is fun, then I've done my job.
Well, it sounds almost Newtonian in that he was the one who said that, you know, he found these things and discovered these things on the shoulders of giants.
That's it. And there's a lovely quote from him, which I'm going to paraphrase horribly. So forgive me, dear Sir Isaac Newton.
I already did. Go on.
It was about being a boy standing on the shore with a pebble, and it's the paraphrase is, you know, what we know is a drop, what we don't know is an ocean. But it's this lovely image that you're a small child standing on the brink of the ocean of knowledge, looking out at what there is to be discovered. And I think that's really inspiring for kids, because there is an amazing universe out there for them to discover, but we need to help them to do that.
Well, you were once a child, and we were joking in the office because I explained that you were coming in and who you were. Yeah. And your reputation obviously preceded you even when you were a 6-year-old.
Well, I'm, I, me, the six-year-old me's had quite an airing because I seem to be six in The Theory of Everything, which is a film about my family life. I seem to say six for an unnaturally long period of time.
Yes.
I took that up with the film producers. Why am I six for the whole of this period? And they said, oh, well, the thing was, if we'd had to get another extra to play you, it would have cost more. So I was like, seriously, you're saying I have to be six for budgetary reasons?
But here's the funny thing, right, is that we were joking that there was no way you could have become a manicurist. there was no future for you that didn't include some kind of pursuit of, and of course you've got language qualifications, you speak French and Russian. There are lots of interesting things about you, but there was no way that you couldn't be clever and you couldn't have ended up with some foot in science, right?
Well, I very much wanted to have a career in the arts. I was quite rejectionist about science at one point in my childhood because I was
rebellious.
Like, yeah.
You were rebellious.
I was rebellious. I was like, yeah, you would say that, Dad. Huh. And I did that whole teenage thing with my father of like, and what would you know anyway? So I may have been one of the few people who've ever said that to him. And now, of course, you know, with age and hindsight, I'm deeply embarrassed that I did that. But still, thank God for teenagers, eh?
Yeah.
I think at one point, perhaps my father's career seemed so overwhelming that it was almost like, well, what's the point of doing anything? You know, you can be overfaced by genius. And there's quite a lesson in that we can all make a contribution in our own way. Not all of us are going to be world beating, and that doesn't matter, but we can all do something. We can all make a contribution and be part of a society.
Well, you said something tremendously humble just a moment ago where you said that if you could just get one child to discover that science isn't that hard and it can be fun.
Yeah.
That would be a massive achievement. But I think your father has made science fun even for people who are genius. Because I won't talk about your dad through 90% of this, I promise you.
That's okay.
In some ways, I mean, you're your own person and you've done incredible things, which deserve the more than the light of day. But I've sat with a brief history of time on my bedside table for, 5 years?
Yep.
And I have to go over some pages 20 times and I still don't entirely understand what's going on.
No, I relate to that experience. It is a challenging read. It's a really good book. It's a good book just in itself out of context. But when you think it's really the first attempt at popular physics publishing, it was when Brief History was published, now there's this massive industry in popular science publishing. It didn't exist at all. Scientists were not making any effort to go beyond the confines of the scientific community to communicate to the general public. And really, my father came along and said, you know, I am a publicly funded scientist. It's kind of incumbent on me. It is my duty to explain to the public what we as scientists do, because after all, you know, we're funded by taxpayers' money. Mm. I mean, he had more elevated and philosophical ideals as that about a scientific literacy and increasing the scientific literacy of the world's population, because that would lead to greater engagement and greater citizenry, all these good things that he hoped would come as a result. But when he wrote the book, you know, there was a considerable sort of people looking down their noses at him in the scientific community. There are some great phrases, like I think Paul Dirac said, you can't be popular and be a physicist. So it was very much not the done thing. And he did that. And that was a real breakthrough. And of course, all these other science communication that we see now, everything from TV programs, the Big Bang Theory to Interstellar, you know, that's where they all start with Brief History of Time. So that in itself is a massive achievement.
Well, maybe you're taking it a step further with George's Cosmic Treasure
Hunt.
Maybe if I'd started with that, I wouldn't be so frustrated and confused.
Yes. As I said, Brief History of Time, even my father admits that it was difficult. And that's why he came back and he did an illustrated Brief History of Time, which I think is really lovely. And Universe in a Nutshell, and those are two books where he has tried to sort of clarify a bit what he was talking about in Brief History. But yes, the idea really of the George series was to offer a way in for young readers, just to open up that doorway for them and say, you can understand, this is fun, it does, but also create that relationship, because I think a lot of kids don't feel that science relates to them. They don't understand what the connection between them and some great abstract concept is. So it's trying to make relationships so that they understand that they are part of the universe and that their brain, although it's part of the universe, can comprehend it.
Well, at this juncture, can I ask you something that I've been struggling with for a long time? How do you determine and how do you decide what is intelligent behavior and what isn't? I mean, how do you know if someone's clever or not? Because this is something that confounds me. I've come to the realization it's not how much you know, but it's how much you want to know that makes you smart. Do you agree with that, or do you think you have a better definition? Because I need help on this topic.
That's a very difficult thing to define, and actually,
you lived with a genius. You're a kind of a genius yourself, in a way.
I mean, there is something I will admit about living with someone who probably has an IQ of over 200 that can be a little, can make life interesting. I don't tend to think of people in terms of clever or not clever. It's about willingness to engage. It's about interest. It's about curiosity. And I believe that you can be clever in all sorts of different ways. So I think just because kids aren't academically clever, it doesn't mean they're not smart. It doesn't mean they don't have talents. And as I said, my point is that everybody can make a contribution. And we're all different. And that's part of the joy of the human race, is that we have this diversity, and we need to find ways to help all these kids unlock their potential in different ways.
I mean, did you and your brothers ever have really, really stupid conversations and someone in the family said, that's really stupid?
Oh, frequently. No, frequently. Because I was like the family joker. I was always telling jokes. And unfortunately, I generally laughed too much at my own joke and fell off my chair before the punchline. So, I just wanted to be an entertainer when I was a kid. So I was the kind of always the larking around, telling the funny story, asking the silly question. But we also had loads of scientists who used to always come for dinner at our house. And they would literally answer any question we put to them as kids. We could ask them anything we wanted. And I've tried to replicate that in the book series. As the books go on, you find more and more voices, science voices coming in. And it's trying to replicate that experience of being a kid in a group of incredibly convivial, genial scientists, all sort of eating supper and coughing wine or whatever, and telling kids, answering kids' questions. So it's trying to replicate that sense of curiosity and engagement.
During your childhood, you must have spent most of it, the time in Cambridge, but you were also in California for a while.
That's right. We went to Caltech for a year when I was little, which was lovely. It was very nice. And that's sort of my earliest memories of life, zooming around the Caltech campus, which I think has produced more Nobel Prize winners than any other place. And we were kids kind of drawing on blackboards and doing cartwheels in the central corridors. I grew up in Cambridge, which is very beautiful and very distinguished.
And ironically, then you went to Oxford rather than to Cambridge.
Wow. Who wants to run into their mum or dad when they're a student all the time? No, so I fled.
So, and at Oxford, you studied Russian and French.
That's right. So I did languages and literature because I said I very much wanted an arts-based career. That was my whole, that's my interest. I was very interested in theatre, in drama, in music and singing. And, what sort of happened with my career is I've taken elements from the creative world and I've applied them to scientific information to make them engaging from kids. So I've tried to sort of almost create this hybrid so that the creative world is so good at engaging people, you know, emotionally. It knows how to pull you in. It knows how to keep you there. It knows how to grab your interest. It knows how to make you care about what you're seeing, what you're experiencing, what you're listening to. And what I realized with scientific information that wasn't available for kids. Nobody was creating that sort of engagement. So I thought, this is what we do. We take these elements and we apply them to abstract scientific information so that it becomes accessible to non-specialist audiences.
But why Russian?
Oh, I mean, Russian is just fascinating. It was really,
it's
I went
such
to
a
Russian.
Different language. They don't even write in the characters we write it.
That is the case, yes. I went to Moscow with my dad, actually, when I was about 14. So it was back in the USSR. And he was going to a science conference. He was one of the few people really allowed
in. Did he often drag you along to these things?
Oh, my God, you have no idea. My parents used to try and sell them to us as holidays. And we'd get there. And my brother and I would be like, he's a physicist. This is a conference, isn't it? We're not on holiday at all.
All right. So you went to Moscow.
I went to Moscow and I was just fascinated by it. I was fascinated by the language and the literature and the history and the politics. I mean, it's very, very different at that time for sort of an impressionable and probably quite pretentious teenager. You know,
were you going around reading Solzhenitsyn and that kind of thing?
I just might have been. As I said, thank God for teenagers. So I carried on studying it, and it's a very rich language and a very rich literature and history and politics. So
when did you realize you had a knack for writing?
When I was at university, one of my tutors took me aside and he said, this essay, he said, that you have done, he said, I'm not going to tell you that I think the content is outstanding, but he said, but it's very well written. And I wondered if you'd considered being a writer. So that sort of gave me an idea, and then I applied. I went and trained for a year as a journalist after uni, and started working in journalism to get that the sort of practice of writing, and carried on sort of in that vein, and wrote two very lightweight novels before I had the idea for the George series. So,
but you speak of that quite dismissively. I mean, it's hard to write. I've written two okay books. And it was the hardest
it's
stuff
really
I've
hard.
Done.
It's really hard. And it never gets easier. That's what I found. I've just written the sixth and final George book. And I keep thinking, this is the sixth one. Why is, but it's never easy. Never.
And you can't go in it to make money.
No.
Because there isn't money in writing anymore.
No.
And
you've got to genuinely love books, love stories. And you have to actually love engaging with your readers. That's the other thing, because especially for children's authors, I do think you have to get out there and you have to talk to kids and you have to do events and you have to kind of try and embody what it is you're getting across to them. You have to make it real and make it come alive for them.
So this George series, mm-hmm. You explained at the beginning that these are kind of accessible to kids,
yeah.
Accessible ways of getting hold of science and making sense of it.
That's right. So what happened was, it was my son's birthday party, and I've told this story a lot of times before, so forgive me if you've heard it before, but it is how it started. My dad arrived, and this little boy came up to me and said, "Oh, Stephen, what would happen to me if I fell in a black hole?" And all the other kids were like really super excited, and they were just standing there, you know, waiting and waiting. And my father said, "You'd be turned into spaghetti." And they were all like, "Yay, spaghetti, spaghetti." And they all kind of just totally understood what he meant. And all the adults were like, "Oh, yeah, so spaghetti. Yes, I thought so." And they had no idea whatsoever. I could just see they were, but they weren't going to admit it. And I just thought, that's a story. That there is a story. What would happen to me if I fell in a black hole? Why would a boy fall in a black hole? How would he get there? How would we get him back? And I could see that dad had the ability to put the answer in terms that a kid, I mean, spaghetti, so relatable. Every kid knows about spaghetti. So I thought, no, this is what we should do. We should tell these stories. And I thought, this is such an obvious idea that I bet there's a book already, and I'll go out and I'll buy it for the kid who asked the question and send it to him. And I found nothing, absolutely nothing for that age group. So I thought, right, well, we've got to do it now. So that's what we did.
And have you found many other ways of explaining things in that simple way that your dad did to them about the black hole?
He's very, very good. That is part of his manifold genius, is this ability to give very simple, clear explanations of things that are just unfeasibly complex.
But most of it would be you doing that.
Well, it's a synergy. I mean, yeah. We've been co-authors.
Yeah, but I mean,
so
you can come up with great metaphors and explanations.
Yeah,
well, too.
I do the plot and the character and the dialogue. And
you're sort of the bridge too.
Yeah.
I mean, you mentioned that the adults didn't understand it because they don't have minds that are open enough to understand it.
They do, and adults have a fear of admitting they don't understand things. Especially, I noticed when it came to physics, because I've been to a lot of physics lectures and I've heard a lot of audience comments as people come out, and I realised that a lot of the adult audience were inspired. But mystified. So they were like, "Wow, that's really amazing. I have no idea what that was about, but it was amazing." And you think, well, that's, you know, we've got to find a way to deliver content in a meaningful way so people go, "That was amazing and I totally get it."
I would imagine that the frustrating thing is they're also trying to prove to you that they kind of get it, just a little bit.
Yeah.
So they're always on a mission to say, "Well, yes, I was in the process of explaining how I understand this." To you, who's not really interested in how they understand it or whether they understand it, but just to take it somewhere.
Yeah.
And with kids, you can take an open mind and you can fill it with really useful information.
That's it.
And from an early age, stop them from becoming jaded.
One of the interesting discoveries I made when doing this book series is that kids and astrophysicists are remarkably alike.
Explain to me how.
They have a sense of wonder. They don't have prejudices. They're not bound by common sense. A lot of physics is very counterintuitive. Mm. And so adults will be like, "Oh, that can't be," or "That, how would that work?" But kids are like, "Oh, yeah, got it. So there's this kind of openness and this willingness to engage with either the very small or the very large, and this willingness to go on a journey of wonder and thrill and discovery for the just sheer joy of it. Not because it's going to benefit, you know, just because you want to. And that I found a communality of outlook.
And can I suggest or proffer that the other thing that they might have in common is not such a massive sense of self in the whole thing, that it's not an ego situation, that they realize that the universe is vast and that they're a tiny part of it, but that they can, by understanding it, become more important
in it. Yes, that's
it. And by understanding, you also have some humility about
your position.
That's
right, because you're not entirely just locked into your own perspective, me, what I have to do today, what my responsibilities, my burdens, my ego, my wishes. You know, it's more about exploration and curiosity.
You have to have a tremendous sense of humor to imagine that all of what you are can be turned into spaghetti in a black hole, and
that's absolutely okay. And when you start to imagine exactly, that's a very good way of putting it.
I do think this is fascinating. I'm also very interested in two things that you're involved in quite intimately. The first one, the National Star College. And are you still the vice president there?
No, I'm not still the vice president, but I still have a lot of warm feelings towards them and wish to support them. It's a college in the United Kingdom that supports some of the most disabled and disadvantaged kids in the UK and helps them to achieve further education. So it's providing, whether it's living conditions or wheelchair technology or assistive communication. And they do really a great job with kids who otherwise could actually just be living in a hospital.
And no doubt that's also as a result of the fact that you saw your father's condition.
That's right. I've lived with a profoundly disabled person for all of my life. And so I'm very well aware of all the challenges and how even the best planned day can be completely thrown off by an unexpected flight of stairs.
Yeah. As if to compound this, you also have a very intimate understanding of and association with autism.
That's right.
Which in itself is misunderstood by so many people.
It is. And it's one of the things that I think, I'm hoping that over the next few years, as there becomes more clarity about autism, people will gain a better understanding. I have actually just made a virtual reality film with the Guardian newspaper in the United Kingdom, which you can find on YouTube. It's called The Party. And if you watch it through a VR headset, then it will put you into the shoes of a 16-year-old girl with autism. And so you will experience autistic perception.
So I want to do this. I will. I'll go and look for the
video.
No, do,
because it's a 6-minute film that took us about a year to make.
So your son, William, is autistic.
That's right.
I have a friend, my first real experience with autism. I have a friend who has a 3-year-old now. He was only diagnosed about a year and a half, 2 years into his life. Mm. They both very, very clever people, the mother and father. The child is, for all intents and purposes, a perfectly, in inverted commas, normal child. He's a little hyperactive. Mm. He's extremely sensitive to noise and to light and to attention and all of these things. But I had them explain to me that his biggest problem is socialization. His biggest problem is that he finds it hard to communicate with other kids. Otherwise, he's entirely capable of doing everything and more than some of the kids that
I imagine. I mean, one of the things you'll find if you do watch The Party, it's about sensory perception.
There's a spectrum though, right?
There is a spectrum, although there may not be. I mean, it's complicated as to how valid the spectrum really is, but that's a moot point for people who know a lot more than I do. But if you watch The Party, as I said, you'll experience sensory overload that autistic people have described to us, because it's all the content is taken from first person interviews with autistic people. The script is written by a young woman with autism. It's voiced by a young actress with autism. So it's as close to an authentic experience as we can do it. And it just shows you all the things that come between that person and their ability to engage in a social situation. It just shows you how overwhelming all the sensory and auditory inputs are and how much more difficult it is. So when you've watched that, you find yourself thinking, well, does this person not want to socialize, or is it just functionally impossible when they've got flashing lights and visual distortions and auditory distortions happening all around them? Then how easy would I find it if I was at a party and this was my experience? So have a look at that and you might find that.
No, it sounds fascinating. Are you still a trustee of the Autism Research Trust?
Very much so. That's Cambridge
University. And they produced this
No, book. I did this with The Guardian, which is a big media group in London.
Okay.
So I think it's the first real virtual reality attempt to do a narrative documentary about a piece of scientific research. So again, it's kind of the same. It's not the same, obviously, as the George series, but it's this central idea of how can we take elements from the creative world and the tech world and apply them to complex information to make it accessible to people who wouldn't otherwise have a way of engaging with it.
Do you share your father's skepticism of artificial intelligence?
I just actually went to see, just before I left London, I went to see a film called AlphaGo, which is about Demis Hassabis, who is kind of almost the father of AI. And it's about the AI he created to, do you know the Chinese game of Go?
Yes.
Right. So it's about AlphaGo.
It's a lot more complicated than chess. So.
I know. And how, because it's intuitive. And, and originally the idea was artificial intelligence would not be able to play Go because it requires human intuition and creativity. Mm-hmm. And then what you see when you watch this game is something quite different. It's an amazing film. I would really recommend it. I think AI has multiple uses that, provided that it's used in the right way and provided we have the ability to harness it, I think it could prove incredibly beneficial to the human race. So no, Dad and I don't see eye to eye on that one.
How much time do you still spend with him?
Well, I saw him on Friday. I spent all Friday with him. So he's kind of busy.
Yeah.
I have to try and work my way into his diary.
The situation, I suppose, is confounding to a lot of people because he has not slowed down one little bit. It seems that as long as he is physically able, he will be putting out great ideas and confronting the big questions of our time. Are you concerned that he might need to take it easy at some point?
I think we've rather given up on hoping he might take it easy. We have tried. We've made suggestions, but
doesn't listen to you.
No, of course not.
Not interested. And do you think that there are things that we are going to discover in the next 5, 10, 20 years that will completely revolutionize the way that the world works?
I hope so.
That people's lives will be improved.
I hope that we will make discoveries that will improve life rather than damage it. I think that's my big hope, that we will find answers to environmental pollution, the big problems we face are environmental pollution, acidification of the oceans, spread of pandemic disease, inequality in all its forms. And these are the things we really need to be tackling. And one of the reasons, again, for doing this George series is to try and give this rising generation a way into science and technology, because they're going to be the people who are going to need to come up with these imaginative, creative, scientific, technological solutions. So they need to get going. They need to get working.
Well, good luck. And starting with children is the best way to make sure that that happens.
Yeah.
Because if we talk to adults, there are just all kinds of obstacles in the way. With kids, it's almost easier. And they're so appreciative of discovering wonderful things.
They are. And they're not boundaried in the way that we are. I have an enormous amount of optimism about the future. And that's because I work with kids and I go all the way around the world and I talk to kids. And they're pretty amazing. I think the next generation is incredible. And I hope they will learn from our mistakes.
How do you deal with well-meaning people, good people who have no axe to grind or nastiness in them, but they're captive to either their religious beliefs, their ideas about how things should work, could work, do work, and discoveries in science which really are at loggerheads with that stuff?
Yeah, that's called normative ethics, isn't it? How things should be. And I think if you could solve that, then please let me know.
Are you empathetic with these people? Are you
it's a bit of a broad category to say I'd be empathetic with.
It's sometimes hard. It's hard to have the conversations because,
yeah. I mean, I think communication
there's almost a default setting to being offended and upset by.
Well, I think that, in a sense, I think one thing that would be a huge improvement is if we could get some civility back into public discourse, and we could learn to listen to other people's views without immediately reaching for insults or anger or whatever. I think that would be an improvement.
In other words, don't go onto social media ever. Lucy, thank you so much for coming to see us.
It's a pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
Sure, and all the best with the rest of your time here in South Africa and the books. And I hope that there are many children all over South Africa who will have their introduction to science in their own language through these incredible books.
That's the important thing, is to reach kids in the way that they can access it, and then the parents will be able to read to their kids. So we really want to take it to them, and I'm so grateful to Paressa and Carol Block for making this happen. It's a really big, big thing that this has come about.
Thank you so much. Lucy Hawking. CliffCentral.com.